Hey guys, it's Graham, and other than $5 gas, what's cracking? Oh boy, I'm training at work. This guy's good, and he is not at all the cause of any of the headaches that I'm currently enjoying. That's got more to do with the Neanderthals in the warehouse. But I haven't done any reading. You know, the thing about training is you got to have your head in the game, so I don't really have anything plugged in, or, you know, not really listening to anything during this week. As I said on Twitter, I am flattered that they want me to train so much, but I do like having time to myself during the week, especially to listen to different things. But that's not the big brouhaha that is going on right now. Right now, our buddy, masculine style guru extraordinaire, Tanner Guzzi, had a take over the weekend, and it didn't take so well with a certain group of people, namely those who are artistic and creative and productive and also find themselves on the right red elephant side of the political spectrum, your side, if you will. The take started in response to the Matt Walsh documentary, What is a Woman? Which, since it's coming from Matt Walsh, it could be equal parts insightful assessment of something and equal parts just deadpan trolling. You never know. I personally am not the biggest fan of Matt Walsh's stuff. I don't think necessarily that his philosophies are askew or anything. It's just sometimes the way that he couches things and puts it out there hits the palate like a razor blade, as it were. For example, I think the one thing that made me mute him the last time I was on Twitter was shortly after Kobe Bryant died. And Walsh's take was something to the effect of like, oh man, the worst part of what that must have been like for Kobe wasn't knowing that he was going to die, but knowing that his daughter was going to die and he couldn't do anything about it. Like, what the hell is in your head that makes you think, I should write this out and broadcast it and send it to the world? Like, maybe he was just trying to telegram his thoughts into the internet about the love that a father has for his children. Okay, sure. In that way and on that issue, big swing and a miss for me. And that was kind of what made me say, okay, like, I really don't want to see anything from this dude anymore. But I digress. He had a documentary called What is a Woman? Made largely in response to the Senate confirmation hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson, our incoming Supreme Court justice, who was definitely hired on merit and not because of skin color and biological sex. Again, I digress. She was asked about transgender something or other, and her response was, I don't know, I'm not a biologist, I can't define a woman. Which, you don't have to be a biologist to define a woman, but that's neither here nor there. I shouldn't have to explain that to you because the discerning audience members of the Rad Cracker podcast are capable of figuring these things out without having them spelled out for him by a trucker who reads a lot of books. You know, so Matt Walsh goes and makes this documentary, and apparently he interviews a bunch of these alphabet blue-haired people that have, you know, big brain takes on big brain things. And Tanner Guzzi's take on it was, you know, this was unnecessary. You know, who's really going to be convinced by this? What's the point of this thing other than, you know, a conservative guy wants to sell a product? And, you know, my two cents here is that the value in a documentary like that isn't just necessarily in impacting anything in the present, although it certainly can. It has that potential, it has that ability. But, you know, me being a reader of historical nonfiction, I personally like to read biographies that were written closer to the life of the source. You know, not because it's a hard and fast rule that they're always going to be unbiased or more accurate, but they're going to show us more about what the people of the time actually thought of the subject of the biography. You know, for example, before I read Ron Chernow's biography, Chernow being a contemporary of mine, before I read his biography on George Washington, I'm going to read Washington Irving's biography of George Washington. I'll probably still read Chernow's, but I want to read something that was closer to the time in which he lived. Documentaries provide that same kind of value. They can show the debate and the discussion that was happening in real time and preserve it for future generations, so that hopefully if this psychopathic gender bender record that society is on right now ever calms down in the future and people say, how in the hell did they ever let it get this bad, or how could it even have possibly been that bad? Maybe it's overblown. Maybe it was never as dangerous as they said it was. No, they'll go back and they'll look at, you know, documentaries like this one and be like, holy crap, people actually with a straight face said this stuff, like women can have a penis and men can have a vagina. It's all about what you think you are in between your ears. No sir, no ma'am, no way, no how. Yeah, so I think there's value in it. I'm not going to go, you know, pay whatever the Daily Wire fee is to watch it. You know, other people have their takes on that, and it is what it is. But, you know, sitting there on the sidelines and taking a swing at it, what does that do? I mean, if we're asking, like, what's the value of this action, then let's apply that question to the action of questioning itself. As an addendum to that, you know, Tanner's follow-up was something to the effect of, you know, right-wingers don't make art. We can't create art. Like, his specific phrasing was that we can't create art, we can't create film, anything like that. And that really put a burr under my saddle, because here I am, a guy who's on the right-wing philosophical spectrum in the 21st century. I'm creating art. I'm publishing my own books. I have been for 8 years. You know, I responded and pointed that out and said, you know, largely the issue is that, you know, people are more loyal to legacy brands of fiction, stuff like Star Wars and stuff like, you know, Marvel and whatever, even though those things have been, you know, in print, they've been crap for 10 years or longer. There are entire YouTube channels going back for years, like, you know, Comics Matter with your boy Zach, documenting the downfall of the North American direct comics market and showing how these legacy brands like Marvel and DC are in the crapper and are only buoyed up by the larger corporations that have bought them out, because somehow, some way, in the dregs of it all, there is still value in the brand recognition. With Marvel, it's largely because of the movies. In DC, it's largely because Superman and Batman are probably the two most popular comic characters ever. But the stuff that's being made under those banners nowadays is just bad, and yet people keep going back to it. You know, meanwhile, those of us on the indie scene who are providing alternatives, very few of us are getting the kind of readership and support and fan base to make our products viable and to be able to produce full-time. A lot of us were sitting here still, you know, working full-time jobs and dealing with other demands on our time, but we're creating better stuff. I was very, very encouraged by two people pushing back against this take from Tanner, one of them being George Alexopoulos, G-Prime85, and the other being Larry Correa, who's been a full-time author for, geez, when did he go full-time? Like 2014, 2015? You know, he's been an accountant, or had been an accountant, for a very long time, and, you know, worked for defense contractors and finally retired from that because he actually, you know, he did like the work well enough, but, you know, he wanted to go full-time into creation, and he had the kind of reader base and support to do that. George Alexopoulos, as popular as he is on Twitter and Instagram, he's still not creating full-time. He doesn't have enough support. He doesn't have enough backing. And, you know, me, all told, I've probably grossed about $1,000 in my writing career in the last 8 years. you know, don't really make any money off of my podcasts. My YouTube channel is growing. I'm up to 940 subscribers. And the closer I get to 1,000, the closer I get to actual monetization. I got to keep figuring out good stuff to make and produce there. The point is that we are out here, and the idea that we can't create is infuriating. We don't have the backing of these massive corporations, and we don't have the viewership, the readership, the fandom of these legacy properties, even by people that hate them. And Larry brought this up by saying that these people would rather complain for the 5,000th time about a bad Disney product than turn their attention and their signal boosting abilities on anything else. One guy that I really like is, you know, the Critical Drinker. I've mentioned him before. He's a great YouTuber. And I really appreciated a take that he had earlier this year when the Daily Wire finally, you know, released its first feature film. I guess it came out late last year. I'm not sure. I didn't see any promotion for it. In fact, the first time I heard of it was Drinker's review of it. It was called Run, Hide, Fight, and it was basically Die Hard as a school shooting instead of as a Nakatomi Plaza Christmas Eve thing. And, you know, Drinker was fair in his assessment of it and said, look, you know, as much as I would like to see better alternatives than just the stuff that's continually pushed out by these big Hollywood studios, I'm not going to sit here and heap praise on something just because it's an alternative. You know, it has to be good. And, you know, to hear Ben Shapiro and the Daily Wire guys tell their side of it, you know, they're the only conservatives that are creating anything in the artistic realm, and that's just flat out not true. We don't have the signal boost that we need, and that's really what it comes down to. You know, we don't have the capital to market the stuff of ours that is good, and so we're doing what we can at the ground level to boost the signal. That's really what Upstream Reviews is all about. You know, we're trying to find the really good stuff and get it out there and share it with people. We are now entering day three of this thing, this beef about creators on the right and stuff, and I've talked a lot about it on the last 2 days, the last two segments. I don't want to go too far at length about it, but it popped up today because not going to name any names. If you know who, then you know who. The bike guy and the deadlifting guy were getting snippy at each other on the Bird app about this issue specifically. You know, the biking guy was saying, you know, you guys say that right-wing art is too in your face, but then you go around and you turn around and you make in-your-face right-wing art, and the deadlifting guy said, you're not doing anything at all. It's drama on the one hand, and generally I approve of a good, healthy, robust debate to help people refine their positions and see if their ideas stand up to scrutiny. A lot of that's been lost in social media because you can just mute the people that disagree with you or provide a counterpoint, and you can go over to the ones that do agree with you. You know, it's effectively shopping for an audience. One thing that the Spiritual Arson episode mentioned was Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and the other Inklings, and how the constant exposure of their ideas to one another led to the improvement of their ideas, and they created the literary works that shaped the Western literary scene for the remainder of the 20th century and are still impactful today. You know, because those ideas were exposed to scrutiny. I think if you were to, you know, create art from a certain point of view that never went through any kind of editing or feedback process or beta reading process, and then you just threw it out there, it would get accepted by those who want to accept it and ignored by those who are keen to ignore it, and it would be no different than a more expensively produced tweet, I guess. And it's easy to ignore tweets if they're stupid or if they don't stand up to scrutiny. In the same breath, it's easy for tweets to find the audience that they're aimed at and reinforce the echo chamber. Which I think kind of goes back to the point Tanner was making on Twitter and on Spiritual Arson, namely that, you know, if the goal is to shift the culture, move the needle, have an influence on people, then don't we need to break out of the echo chamber? And I think putting something behind a paywall that's already tailored to an audience that's going to agree with it, the paywall kind of pulls it away from the audience that might be partial to it but hasn't discovered that perspective, you know? You know, nobody is casually picking up the Daily Wire on their expensive monthly or annual subscription so that they can see what they're about. If you're paying for the Daily Wire, you know what they're about. You're just looking for an alternative. So I'm kind of talking in circles around this whole issue, but it just comes to the same point. You know, if you're tired of the big stuff, go find the indie stuff. And if the indie stuff isn't great, all these people have Twitter handles or ways to reach them through email or through social media. Let them know constructively what did or didn't work for you. I think that'll be more beneficial than just, you know, leaving a faceless one-star review on Amazon, which you're completely entitled to do, don't get me wrong. But better art, it's the result of a process of exposure to resistance. You know, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. What do they say in boxing? Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. You know, let your ideas get punched by all means. All right, now that I've talked enough about that, I haven't done Music Corner in a week or two, and I was sharing some music with my wife last night. Rob was tweeting about some 90s music, late 90s, you know, early 2000s. For me, that was the beginning of high school. That was my high school career. For him, he was probably, you know, just getting out of college. I'm not sure exactly how much older he is than me. I'd give him about 10, maybe 15 years tops. But we were talking about, he mentioned Our Lady Peace, not Old Lady Peace. I almost said Old Lady. Our Lady Peace. And I think they became famous in the late 90s for a song called Superman's Dead. I'm not sure I've ever heard that song. But they've got another one called... I keep confusing them with The Calling because the guy kind of has a similar voice. Somewhere Out There. And, you know, it's one of those alt-rock power ballads that I was telling my wife. It's like, I probably put this on mixed CDs for, like, 5 different girls, and even the girls that didn't like me liked my mixed CDs, so, you know, I was that guy. It's just the typical pining of the heart stuff, and, you know, there are enough people that have that cardio pining conditions that music like that has and probably always will resonate with an audience somewhere. That one's a really great song that does that. The other song that was kind of by this one-hit wonder band right around the same time, you know, early 2000s, was Wherever You Will Go by The Calling. And you know it was a certain type of emotional corpo music because it was on Smallville, it was on the WB at the time. I think they had 2 or 3 songs by The Calling that they played in the show, and then they'd pimp it after, you know, the end of the show. It's like, oh, buy this music by these WB label artists. Back in the day when teenagers would hang out at malls like me, I remember there was one of these like kiosk booths, but it wasn't them like pushily trying to sell you something. It was just like, oh, here's this cool thing and you can try it. I can't remember how much it cost, but it was a karaoke booth. And, you know, I had half decent pipes, didn't have a whole lot of range, but if I found the right range, I could stay in there and rub some butter on a song, you know? And I was flipping through there. I was like, yeah, let's try this one out. I think I took my brother and his friends to the mall and saw this karaoke booth. They were way too cool to do something like that. There was no way in hell they would do that, but I would do it all day long. So I hopped in there and I found Wherever You Will Go by The Calling, and a small crowd, maybe like 5 or 6 people had gathered, and there was this one dude who was there with his girlfriend, and I like locked eyes with this chick. I was singing to his girl right in front of him, and she was into it. I'm not sure, you know, whatever happened to that, if she, you know, went home and yelled at him, like, why don't you sing like that to me? That blonde guy at the mall sang like that to me. And other things that only happen in my fantasies, but they'll end up in a book at some point. Anyway, every age probably thinks that, you know, every generation probably thinks that, you know, they had the real gems of their musical era. I think that just every generation has gems and often forgotten gems. It's not the ones that get all the radio time or that are pushed by the big labels. There's plenty of good stuff out there, and I think it's fun to attach good memories to good music. You know, good music can, you know, make you feel a certain way, but it can also be a memory trigger. It can take you back to a certain time and be like, you know, this was cool. I liked XYZ about this particular time in my life. I'm not moving over, dude. Oh, it's a woman driver. That explains it. So anyway, by all means, jump on the music machine of your choice. Look up Somewhere Out There by Our Lady Peace, and Wherever You Will Go by The Calling. I wonder if you younger pups have heard those tracks. Okay, day two of this week, and attempt number 9 or whatever to record this freaking segment. Because I'm an idiot, now I gotta go back to work and try to find my $30 multi-tool knife that probably fell out of my pocket. Because, anyway, I listened to this week's Spiritual Arson when Tanner and Adam were talking about the brouhaha over the weekend from the aforementioned clip. And I will say that I'm a little bit more amenable to what Tanner said his position was. Namely that, you know, he didn't understand what the benefit of this Matt Walsh documentary was, because it was pitched to an audience that was already going to agree with it and then put behind a paywall. So what did it really do to, you know, advance a positive value or a cause or whatever? And he and Adam went on to have a larger discussion about art in general. They talked about The Chosen, which I've been told is a really good show. My wife has watched some of the episodes of it. You know, I think it's a great project for, you know, these independent studios to take on. I understand that it's been having distribution issues. None of these big studios want to touch it. Couldn't possibly be, because it espouses positive Christian values. Or they talked about how, you know, George Alexopoulos pitched an animated project that he originally based off of like a 4-panel comic he did, where a kid goes and talks to his mom and says, you know, hey, my 6 brothers were talking to me. And the mom goes, you're an only child. And he goes, no, they visit me at night. They want me to tell you their names. And, you know, basically like a horror story about a kid who is like his mom's 7th pregnancy or something. She aborted the other 6. And, you know, Tanner and Adam were kind of coming against that, as it would be kind of heavy-handed as far as a concept. Now, on the one hand, to an extent, I understand the complaint that they have. You know, if you're trying to create art that has your values, but it's just defined by what it opposes, then what's it really accomplishing? And again, I can see a certain angle from which they might have a valid complaint, specifically when you look at the quality, ho-hum, of all of the Marvel stuff since Phase 4 of the MCU started, because it's all basically the same plot: white people bad, people with intersectional points good, and the villain was understandable, and white people bad. The girl was awesome all along, people were just in her way, and, you know, to that I reply, well, if she was awesome all along, then why didn't she push those people out of her way? But I digress, I'm getting out into the weeds. I feel like the point of their complaint overall was, you know, what are you doing to positively espouse your values through your artwork and not define it by what it opposes? This is a thought that I've had of my own for the last probably year or so, as I've realized that a lot of my writing projects are basically, okay, let's take popular property X and change component Y to yield result Z. That makes it formulaic, and that's not great. Now, it can be a good jumping off point, but it's not necessarily very original. My Brimstone project is Blast Crew Goes to Mordor. Like, you know, my take on a Tolkien-esque type thing. But the longer I let that one simmer and brew in the background of my head, the more I want to change the story beats and the elements of it that are flagrantly Tolkien-esque. I still want it to be about a blast crew that goes on an epic quest, but I want to remove so much of the tongue-in-cheek elements of it, we'll say. I don't want it to be explicitly defined by its relation to Tolkien. You know, not that I have any problem with Tolkien's values, obviously I don't, but I want to create something that is a Graham Bradley creation. And what is Graham Bradley about? I want to be, you know, known as a Latter-day Saint artist. My art doesn't necessarily have to be proselytizing art, but it has to be art centered on the values that I hold to be true and real. So that's something that's been brewing in the back of my head. And from that perspective, I can understand Tanner's complaint. Well, it's like, well, all you did was make something that was political, even if it is accurate, but then, you know, put it behind a paywall and charged people who agreed with it so that, you know, you could fill the coffers a little bit. Now, I think the defensibility of Walsh and the Daily Wire's position from there is, okay, well, if you got a good return on your investment, a good return on your costs of making this documentary, what do you do with it from there? In a week, the Daily Wire is going to air the movie that they made with Gina Carano, who they picked up as an actress and producer after she was unjustly dismissed from her role as Cara Dune at Disney Star Wars. I really, really, really hope it's a good movie. I am only hesitant because I've seen the reviews and the content stuff from Daily Wire's other creation, that Run, Hide, Fight movie. And it's rated R. There's 30 F-bombs in it. There's a whole bunch of violence. And I thought, you know, what is the point of this? Just to make an action movie that people would pay to see and that money goes to this particular ideological group instead of the other one? What's the merit to that? What's the benefit to that? Okay, well, maybe they're making something that is basically desirable and accessible for a fee, so that they can continue to build the studio and hopefully then make what they want. From that perspective, I think I see the question that Tanner is bringing to the forefront. But my response remains the same. I'm right here making good stuff. I'm telling stories and with themes and characters and world building that is based on the things that I hold to be spiritually true and valid. In Engines of Liberty, Calvin was rebelling against tyranny and oppression, but his character arc was focused on how he had to have more than just his rage, and his rage wasn't always justified. He had to learn in a hard and humiliating fashion how and when to pump the brakes. In The Hero Next Door, Nick's arc was centered on, you know, him learning that he was largely the cause of his own problems. And it was humiliating, but liberating in the right sense, when he had to realize that he was causing pain to other people and that he needed to develop the ability to let the words and actions of other people roll off his back. Now, that's not going to be his complete arc. I just felt like that was a very powerful lesson for a teenager to learn, you know, to be able to recognize contempt and hostility and enmity in yourself when you don't think that you have it toward other people. In Kill the Beast, Gautier had to realize that he was just being shallow, and that just because he was the biggest and the strongest didn't mean that he could just take whatever he wanted. He had to learn how to have a real romantic defeat and how to play the game differently, as it were. Mr. Friday, I don't think Jonathan Rigel had too much of a character arc. That was just a guy with a core who went through an evolving set of circumstances. And I think I made it pretty clear in the first of the three parts of that book that he wanted to be done with it, but it wasn't done with him, and he had to push harder and harder to get out of it. That's a short enough book. I don't want to spoil any more on that front. You know, sometimes the arc is is more for the story than it is for the character, and it's more of a revelatory process for the reader to see like just what this character has inside them. That's kind of what it was with Sheriff Porter. You know, I don't really think that he was super different at the end compared to the beginning, but he did learn some things. He had very obvious contempt for Agent Reed early on, and we saw how that resolved. And you know, we can tell from the very beginning that the most important thing to him in the world is his relationship with his daughter. And you know, even that changes in a way that is most consistent with the values that I think are what's the word that I'm looking for here? Paramount. You know, I'll have similar things in the future. You know, it's not going to be, I don't want it to be on the nose, but I want to work those elements into the world building. A lot of the Intrepids, there are going to be different ways that people come to be an Intrepid, to have, you know, quote unquote superpowers. But the vanilla middle of the road way involves, you know, peak health and peak food intake, you know, not eating modified foods, getting the sleep that you need, things like that. Like, that's the road towards unlocking powers. And, you know, it might even be a shadowy government figure type conspiracy to, you know, pump all of our processed food full of specifically soy and corn and seed oil derivatives, because those are things that are hindrances to unlocking what your peak performance superpowers are. Slightly for the meme, but it works within the context of the world building for that particular series. And I do have a longer arc reveal planned for something in the Ghost Wars series. That's going to be, you know, generally the books that contain Josie Penninger and Silas Proctor. I've established there's an astral plane that's kind of where the intelligences hang out. I've established, you know, the mortal plane and the spectral plane and the fractal plane, and those things all have hard, strong parallels to the realms of existence in the Plan of Salvation, which would then needs mean that if somebody becomes, like, makes the transition from an intelligence to a spirit at the moment of quickening, we'll say, at the moment of conception, but then, you know, they die in utero, what happens to that spirit? I have an answer for that planned out in this series. But I don't want to be heavy-handed with it and be like, oh my goodness, all these angry poltergeists are ghosts of aborted babies. Like, I don't want to beat people over the head with that. I want them to be able to see that on their own. Anyway, what this whole thing comes down to is, once again, we are out here, we're getting it done, and if you want more of it, you got to support what we're doing. That's your role in this. My role is to keep getting better at it. You want to hear the worst sound ever? Oh, come on. Come on. Now it won't make it? Jeez. The track on my sunroof is bad, basically. Is that gonna, it's gonna turn off. And so it sounds like the devil strangling a cat with a squeegee every time I close it. But of course, I gotta do it for you fine folks, just to spread the agony around. It doesn't freaking work. Okay, segment four, it is Thursday and we have not been subjected to another day of the right-wing artist debate on the Twits. So that's cool. Now, the bigger news is some California whack job crossed a significant number of state lines with a gun with the intent to, we'll say, snuggle a Supreme Court justice to sleep permanently. But, you know, all the media wants to talk about is a couple of nonviolent trespassers from a year and a half ago and make it sound like that was the coming of the apocalypse. I only mention this because I know that my devoted listeners understand what's really going on. I only mention this to highlight it for new listeners in case they are not of the see the news and understand what's happening persuasion. The news is crap, in case you didn't know. This has been going on for a while, but it's just gotten worse. And we are in a state of a very, let's say, cool and cordial civil war. But it is a civil war nonetheless. We just haven't started shooting at each other. But if anybody's going to follow the whack job example from California, that might change soon, and I definitely do not want it to. Speaking as a guy who has read a lot of history about the Civil War, boy howdy. Anyway, it is a lovely 86 degree day. I should have been off work 2 hours ago, but like an idiot, I answered my phone when the dispatcher called and he needed me to go pick something up from somewhere. So I learned my lesson. But you were headed back to the valley. Yeah, and you made me drive out to the airport. We have a weight room, and I was using it yesterday after work, and one of the other guys left, and he knew that I was already done. He's like, hey, I saw the Durango. What's going on? I was like, no, I'm just lifting weights. You know, come join me. He's like, nah. But if you're looking for something to do, you know, dispatch needs a guy to run a couple of hot shots. Those are the smaller trucks that just run a couple of cases a long distance or whatever. And I was like, look, I don't run hot shots. I am the hot shot. There's a thing about getting cocky. It's always bitten me in the rear end. And this time will likely be no different. But every once in a while, it's fun to just speak the truth. even if you're amping up the braggadocio a little bit. But I am being aware of it. So I probably won't go too far with it this time. I do understand my value at the company, and I understand the unique attributes and qualities that I bring to the company. I also understand that if you toot your own horn too much, you're asking for trouble. I'm not going to be that guy. I'm just going to bring it up every once in a while. By the way, I'm one of the best dudes you have. Bloody Nora, too. They put out a call for drivers to go out of state again next week, and I told my wife after Kentucky that I wasn't going to do that. You're not really doing it, are you? Bro. This guy almost cut me off when I had the right-of-way, and he's in a dump truck. Now, I told my wife I wouldn't do it again after Kentucky unless it was for a very select range of cities. And lo and behold, one that I hadn't even thought of but was yet, you know, excruciatingly obvious was Maui, Hawaii. They're like, yeah, we might need a driver to go to Maui for a week. I texted my supervisor. I'm like, bruh, I got family stuff next week, but if it ends up getting pushed or they need one later, like, I call hella dibs. And like, let me just make a life tip recommendation level thing here. Get a supervisor to whom you can call hella dibs on a trip to Hawaii for work. It feels so good. What else? Yesterday, I had a crowdfunded comic come in the mail. So it came with some perks and goodies and stuff, too. I think I backed this one, like, last year, maybe a year and a half ago. They've been sending out updates on the regular, and I didn't, you know, film myself unboxing it, but I've got all the goodies now. I'm going to go home and do a video of it this afternoon. It looks really, really cool. I haven't done all of the reading on it yet, but yeah, I want to spare my thoughts on it, but it's basically got like gorillas with wings and machine guns, and the art is excellent, and I am completely sold. It's the sort of thing that's directly up to my alley. What the hell? I'm also working my way through the second book. I guess it's the first full book in the Black Badge series. I read Dead Acre, I think, like I said, you know, about a year and a half ago. First book came out last month. And I'm a good chunk through it, and it's fine. You know, it's great for what it is. It's just also a lot rougher with language and content than the novella was. And I've always found that really annoying. Maybe it's just me, but you know, you get into a series and like they set the expectation for content warning going forward, and then they get a couple more volumes into it, and they're like, yeah, why don't we kick this up from about a 4 to an 8. It's like, you don't have to do that. Like, I mean, everybody wants to be a big boy, and so they do it by saying naughties all the time in art. And like I've got a threshold for that. Like I can stomach it up to a point. I just think that these two authors who wrote this book that I'm reading right now, they've come up against that point and they've pushed past it a couple of times. Not thrilled about that. It's the kind of thing that just makes me think more about this protracted debate that I've had with myself, RE, profanity in my own works. And I think a lot about how, like, wouldn't it be cool to have this long-running series you could get into that reliably wasn't rough or crass or coarse with the language and just go from there? Like, I understand the arguments that some people say about writing mercenary characters, and it's like, you know, to be realistic about these guys, you know, one of the qualities is the way that they talk. I understand that. I'm not going to argue against that. I just don't want to do it. That's all. This is speaking as a guy who's worked in garages, you know, worked around mechanics, worked around trucks. Like, I understand that people don't, or that people talk that way. Doesn't mean that I want to write characters that talk that way. I understand that people have copious amounts of extramarital sex. I'm probably not going to write a bunch of whores as characters in my stories. You can get that anywhere. Doesn't mean you got to get it from me. I'd rather go the more challenging and rewarding route. Okay, cats, another Friday is upon us. I'm going to head up the mountain, get some work done, come home, and jump into the weekend. Work on some home improvement projects. And maybe find a few hours here and there to lock myself in the office and work on something creative as well. I put up another video yesterday. It breaks down a comic book that I got off of Indiegogo from a crowdfunding campaign that started a couple of years ago. I think these crowdfunding campaigns are really cool, even if it does take a little while to get the project finished and to you. I've only had one that I've backed that I never got. Still waiting to hear back from the guy and what the hell happened, but that is a risk that you run with it. But check out the channel for a video on Battle Brick Road. And that's really it. I think I've said everything I meant to say this week on the subjects that I brought up. And it's hard to get my last two brain cells smashed together to say anything super inspiring heading into work at 2:30 in the morning. Just keep grinding. Stop every so often to evaluate what you're doing and make the grind productive. I think it's been working for me lately. You know, sit back and think, you know, what is the objective? To get my stuff out there in the world? Okay, how do I do that? Every once in a while, I'll come up with an idea for, you know, moving some books. And it's working. I've got some paperbacks of Hero Next Door that I've sold this week. Got to draw some custom artwork in those and get them out of here. And a friend of mine bought a copy of Sleepless Hollow. He's going to read for the first time. Not everybody spends as much time in between my ears as I do. And while I am well acquainted with my creative works, I've got to remember that not everybody else is. So got to lean into the mentions and the pitching of it. And eventually people will get interested. Thank you to everybody who's been supportive of the Rad Cracker podcast, people who have subbed to the YouTube channel and who have bought my books. As of right now, I am 58 subs away from 1,000. And once I get 1,000, I should be able to monetize the channel. And that will get me ever closer to making money off of what I actually want to do. That's all for now. You guys know the drill. Drive safe. See you out there.